Right. So thank you very much. So actually, so this is a report on work which is very much still in progress. I mean, the sort of basic picture by now is pretty clear. But some aspects of the story are still in flux, and one aspect of the story is what the things are going to be called. So the latest version of it is that we call them spectral networks rather than S-wall networks. So this is joint work. One more. It's in progress. So in keeping with the style of sort of the previous talks here, I want to formulate what we did in sort of a relatively mathematical way, although now that I'm looking around, I see that actually it's mostly physicists here. So feel free to ask me at any moment what's the physics of what I'm saying. Usually there's an answer. So sort of mathematically speaking, what are we going to do? So I'm going to introduce, or let's see, we introduce a new structure. Which depends on the following set of data. So you start with a Lie algebra. In the fullness of time, it should be any ADE Lie algebra. But for now, for this talk, we've thought most thoroughly about the SLK case. So let me just talk about SLK. Take a k minus 1. Smooth, compact, complex curve, which I'll call C. And now a point of the Hitchin base of C. But what does that mean? That means a tuple phi 2 up to phi k, where so phi I is going to be a meromorphic section of k to the I, in other words, a k differential. So we have this curve, and we put on it a quadratic differential, cubic differential, and so on up to a k differential. It's interesting already in the case k equals 2. So there you just have a curve with a quadratic differential. And the last little bit of data will be a phase, so a number that I call theta. Maybe you'd rather think about e to the I theta, which is just a so these are our, so this is not the new structure. This is the data that leads to the new structure.
Does compact mean there's no puncture?
Very good. So I think of C as not having punctures on it, but then I allowed these guys to be meromorphic. In the usual language of the, okay, very good. So in one moment, I think I'll answer your question. Given a curve and a point of the Hitchin base of that curve, we're going to produce a new gadget, which we call a spectral network. So as I say, it's a purely mathematical thing. Physicists would probably like to think of it in the following way. Given exactly this set of data, there's a natural n equals 2 supersymmetric quantum field theory associated to it. To be precise, there's an n equals 2 theory and a point of its Coulomb branch. But which theory it precisely is depends a little bit on what poles I've taken for these differentials. As I think probably most of the physicists have heard this story before, but there's a standard machine where you take the n equals 2 comma 0 superconformal field theory in 6 dimensions. That theory comes in ADE flavors. Let's take the AK minus 1 theory and compactify it on the curve C with some defect operators inserted. And the positions of those defect operators are exactly where these meromorphic sections have poles.
So you're saying that the only data that you need from analyze the positions and orders of poles?
The data that determines the field theory itself is just the positions of the poles. But here I'm going to say is the positions and some data about the nature of the poles, you know, what order they have, etc. That's right. That determines the field theory. Or, you know, you would say that determines a particular choice of Hitchin system. But here, in fact, I'm always going to fix myself to look at a particular point of the Coulomb branch. I'm going to look at a particular point of the Hitchin base. And that, of course, depends not only on the poles, but on the whole differentials.
Is that equal to theories in four dimensions?
In four dimensions, yes. In four dimensions, because it comes from taking the 2,0 theory in six dimensions and compactify it on the curve C.
Are you not compactifying on S1 yet?
I'm not compactifying on S1. In the end of the talk, I may compactify on S1. But that's right. Calling this the Hitchin base is sort of motivational for people who like Hitchin systems. But that's right. The Hitchin system won't appear directly. Only the Hitchin base will appear directly for most of the talk. So as I say, so for physicists, the right way of thinking of this will be that the spectral network is something that's attached to this n equals 2 theory. And from the spectral network, so the program is, yeah, we're introducing this new object, and this new object allows you to compute all kinds of things. So the first thing that'll allow us to compute, or one thing that'll allow us to compute, is a system of sort of integer invariants that are attached to every point of the Hitchin base, every point of the Coulomb branch will attach a bunch of integers, which in physics you would think of as the BPS degeneracies of this four-dimensional theory. And in mathematics, you would think of as generalized Donaldson-Thomas invariants for a certain local Calabi-Yau threefold. So that's one thing you can do with these spectral networks. Another thing that you can do with these spectral networks.
This is refined, that's the same refined sort of thing. What do you mean generalized?
No. Good. I don't mean refined here. So there's the notion of Donaldson-Thomas invariance, which has been around for a while and which doesn't involve a stability condition. So in terms of, let me say it in the way a physicist would say it. The usual Donaldson-Thomas invariants have to do with sort of counting D0 brains and D2 brains. In other words, they're counting sheaves that are supported only on, bound to a D6 brain. It's counting only some subset of the possible sheaf. Now, there's a more general thing called generalized Donaldson-Thomas invariant that counts more general combinations of sheaves. That's the thing that's been studied by Bridgeland and so on. So when I say generalized Donaldson-Thomas, I mean generalized in that sense, generalized to depend on a stability condition.
Also, we are thinking of four-dimensional field theory.
What's that?
So four-dimensional field theory.
Four-dimensional field theory. They are the BPS degeneracies in this four-dimensional field theory.
Yeah, but so local Calabi-Yau would correspond to five-dimensional by geometric engineering.
Well, the Calabi-Yau I have in mind. So. Okay. So to be, I'm not sure if this will answer your question, but let me say precisely what I a little more precisely what I mean. So they're attached to the Fukuya category of this local Calabi-Yau threefold. So they're counting. That's right. Sorry, this is actually mirror dual to the counting of sheaves. So these things are counting special Lagrangian submanifolds. But no, I really insist this is going to be four-dimensional. This is going to be four-dimensional field theory, not five-dimensional field theory. But we can talk about that. We can talk about that at the end.
The techniques will be able to get the refined.
We may well be able to get the refined, but I'm just trying to give sort of a feeling of what kind of things this is connected to.
So what is this Calabi-Yau threefold?
Yeah, the Calabi-Yau threefold is the one that was introduced by Enescu, Pantev, and that's embarrassing. Enescu, Nagy, Pantev. What it is you take the curve C and you take an AK minus one singularity fibered over C.
Can you attach this category also to just the curve?
Okay, that's a good question. So it seems like it should be possible to define it directly in terms of the curve. That's what we would have naively thought. So in the case k equals 2, I should say, most of this story is already really developed. It's not in progress. And in that case, you know, we kind of thought, oh, there should be some category attached to the curve. Now, for reasons that I still don't fully understand, Tom Bridgeland and Ivan Smith have been developing the story of what is actually the appropriate category. And they claim that it's really better to think in terms of this local Calabi-Yau threefold than about the curve. I mean, of course, the physics does predict it's attached to a local Calabi-Yau threefold. So it's consistent with what we thought. I don't know why there isn't a way of saying it just in terms of the curve.
Well, then everything about that Calabi-Yau threefold is eventually in terms of the curve.
I agree. In some formal sense, even talking about that Calabi-Yau threefold is talking about the curve.
Yeah.
So it's attached, but I mean,
usually the Calabi-Yau threefold description is much simpler than the curve. The curve is not a natural description in all cases.
That seems to be what they're saying, is that it's better to think about the threefold, although it's in some sense determined by the curve.
Well, the other way around, I would say.
No, but I mean still the Fukaya category.
Yes, the Fukaya category is that Calabi-Yau threefold.
Yeah, but that someone knows about strings, okay? And I thought you didn't want to have the strings.
I didn't say I didn't want to have the strings. I have no comment about it. I think this is a correct statement.
How does it depend on the point in the Hitching base? I mean, there is no...
Well, that's the stability condition. So this local Calabi-Yau threefold exactly has the property that space of stability conditions is the Hitching base. It's the moduli of complex structures for this Calabi-Yau threefold. So you have that ADE singularity, and you can deform it, and the deformations correspond to these differentials. Okay, anyway, so this is still just to motivate you to be interested in these spectral networks. So they're supposed to be connected to other things. So another thing that they're supposed to be connected to is cluster coordinate systems, well, a cluster coordinate system on the space of flat. G connections on C, more exactly, connections with singularities at the poles of the phi I. So this. For physics, it corresponds to computing vacuum expectation values of line operators on R3 times a circle. And the last thing that it's connected to is, for physics, it's connected to, in fact, this is somehow the most fundamental way of thinking about it, is it's connected to the framed 2D 4D wall crossing. In other words, it's connected to wall crossing for BPS states, not just in the pure 4D theory, but in the 4D theory with a surface operator inserted. Okay. So this is, as I say, this is just the motivational picture. But any more questions about the motivational picture?
Is it supposed to give you some information about the original six-dimensional system?
It doesn't. I mean, I never know how to answer this question. So, I mean. The question is, does this give somehow some new information about the original six-dimensional theory? And I would say no. It's just that these networks will just be a new way of analyzing the compactification of that six-dimensional theory. I don't think we've learned anything fundamentally new about the degrees of freedom of the six-dimensional theory or anything like that from these investigations. Okay. So maybe I should start and tell you what this spectral network is. So I'll keep the data.
Can we do it for the SUA systems?
Yeah, so as I say, so all of what I'm saying here is in progress. For A1, it's been completely done. For AK minus 1, we expect to be doing it, you know, very shortly. For D and E, the physics looks like it should be possible, but, you know, I hesitate to claim that it's going to be easy to do it. You know, sometimes if you do something for A, it's not so easy to do it for D and E. So it should be possible, but I'm not claiming we'll do it next week or anything like that.
So what blocks you, something about the roots?
I'm not saying that there's any fundamental obstruction that I know about. I'm just saying I haven't tried.
It's actually a big deal going from rank 1 to higher rank just for the A's.
That's right. But you might think that was the main jump, and once you've gone from... Yeah. I just don't know, so I don't want to make a big claim about doing D-Re. Okay, so what is this spectral network? Just to get oriented, the spectral network is going to be a sort of generalization of a triangulation. In the case of A1, spectral networks will be equivalent to triangulations of the curve. So here's how we make the thing. So first, the spectral network is going to be made out of gadgets that I call spectral trajectories. So what are they? Well, let's introduce the spectral cover for the Seiberg-Witten curve, which is just in these theories, the natural way of presenting the Seiberg-Witten curve is just as a k-fold cover of the curve C, defined by this equation. So this is an equation inside the cotangent bundle of C. So this lambda is a cotangent vector to C, and these phi i's are differentials of the appropriate kind. So this equation makes sense. So this is a k to one branched cover. So it's the Seiberg-Witten curve, or for Hitchin systems, it's the spectral curve. I'll assume that I'm at a sort of generic point of the Coulomb branch, or a generic point of the Hitchin base, just for convenience, meaning that I'll take the phi I to be generic. And what I really mean by generic here is that this covering only has simple branch points. So they're branch points where two of the sheets come together and are interchanged, not some more complicated. So let's call the roots. The roots of this equation, or in other words, the sheets of the covering, let's call them lambda 1 up to lambda k. Of course, I can't do that globally because they'll be permuted with each other as I move around on the curve C. But locally on C, I can do that. So these are complex one-forms, in fact, holomorphic one-forms. Locally defined holomorphic one-forms on the curve. And now I'm going to define a bunch of trajectories. So let's define an ij trajectory to be just an oriented path on C. Along which this one form, e to the I theta, so we had this phase theta in the story from the beginning. So we take the one form lambda I minus lambda j and just rephase it by e to the I theta. So that's a one form, and let's ask for it to be real and positive. So that condition defines these trajectories. So what do they look like? Okay, now I'm going to erase my list of data here. So for fixed I and j, so I look locally on a little bit. Yes, sir.
You picked a point on C and ordering of the sheet.
Yeah, this is just a local thing. So just in some neighborhood where that covering can be trivialized.
So it's relative to a given point and given labeling of the sheet.
Yeah, so the way I like to think about it is that, I mean, this I and j are really labels of the sheets. They're not numbers. So just think of the trajectories are labeled by pairs of sheets. And having, once I've fixed a pair of sheets, I have a notion of the corresponding trajectory. Sometimes for convenience, I'll write numbers, but
that would be the neighborhood of a given point. have to start. You have to have some reference point to do this.
Well, so
you can't say the labeling is not like if when you go far away, it will be a different label.
No, that's right. What I'm saying is that at any point, given a pair of sheets, I can define what it means to have the corresponding. Yeah, all right. If you like, let's just say that we.
It's a trajectory in brackets relative to the neighborhood of a given point.
Sure. So.
I always have this argument with Andy. If you like, choose a trivialization of the cover by choosing some cuts.
Because when you go around, they might switch, right?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. It's only a local motion. Yeah.
You cross the cuts, there's some modicum.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's right. So for fixed INJ, for a fixed pair of sheets,
they're labeled by a local system.
Yes.
You have trajectories labeled by a local system on a functor curve.
Exactly. So that's the way I prefer to think about it. I prefer not to trivialize the thing, but either way is fine. In fact, when I draw pictures, I will trivialize it because I want to write actual numbers. So for fixed INJ, these give, as you say, locally trivialize the thing. Then I can talk about fixed INJ. So then these things give a foliation of the curve. So I have some foliation, which just looks like this. And each of these things I label with ij to keep track of the two sheets. Now, what does this foliation look like? Well, it has some singularities. So this foliation is singular at points where my two eigenvalues collide, where lambda I equals lambda j. These are the branch points of the covering. Or let's call them better the ij branch points. There's lots of branch points, and I only care about the ones where these two particular sheets collide. So in a neighborhood of such a point, the foliation looks a little more intricate. So, actually, it's better to draw it first. So what the trajectories look like in the neighborhood of one of those points is like this. There's a sort of three-prong singularity. So this is the trajectory structure. Now, if I want to keep track of, if I want to label them with a definite I and j and orient them, then I'll have to remember the fact that as I go around this point, I and j actually get interchanged. So I'll put a branch cut here, and I'll trivialize my sheets on the complement of that cut. Then I can really orient this thing. So this is the foliation now by ij trajectories. And it looks weird. They look inconsistently oriented, but it's just because here they have a cut that reverses I and j. So that's sort of the local behavior near the branch points. Is this three-pronged? The key thing here is this three-prong structure, and it's also singular at the places where I've put the poles. So I chose at the beginning of the story. I chose these differentials that have poles, and so the solutions of these equations may well also have poles. And at such a singularity, we can have various different behaviors of this foliation. I'll just draw some sort of representative possible behaviors. So for the weakest kind of singularity, the structure looks like this. In Hitchin language, this would correspond to having a Higgs field with nilpotent residue. And then you have, for higher order singularities, which in fact is what we typically like to study, you'll have some behavior where the trajectories are all spiraling into the singularity. Sorry, I draw these. Singularities will be blue dots. Or even for higher order singularities, which would correspond to irregular Higgs fields with irregular singularity, the trajectories can get sort of grouped into little bands like this. Anyway, there's some characteristic behavior near every singularity of the differentials. Okay, so that's what we call IJ trajectories. In the 2, 0 theory, these are the trajectories along which an IJ string can be stretched while being supersymmetric. Now I can define the spectral network. So what the spectral network is it's a network, no surprise, it's a network of spectral trajectories on C, which we build up as follows. So I'm going to describe it as constructed by a sort of algorithmic procedure. You could turn this into a statement, it's a unique trajectory with thus and so conditions, but I think it's actually easier to follow this way. So what we do is, we begin at the branch points. So at each one of these branch points where two sheets of the where two sheets are colliding, we have these three special trajectories coming out. And we just draw those three special trajectories. So if this is an IJ branch point, I'll have three trajectories coming out. This one is IJ oriented out. This one is JI. I have put my cut here. So now what you do, so from each branch point, you just have three trajectories shooting out, going all over your curve, whatever they do. And then, now it may sometimes happen that two trajectories actually hit each other. It won't happen for two trajectories of the same kind. Two IJ trajectories would never hit each other because they foliate the curve. But it could happen that an IJ hits a JK, for example. And if they do, so we evolve these trajectories for infinite time. And if they cross, then they can give birth to a new one. Let's say they can spawn a new one. So the picture is like this. So if an IJ trajectory hits a JK trajectory, then they just continue on their way. But there's also a new one that's born at the moment of intersection, which is an IK trajectory. And similarly, there's a similar picture, just with the order reversed. So if I put JK here, IJ here, JK, IJ, and again it gives you an IK. And so whenever they hit, they create a new one, and then you let that one run all around the surface forever. And you just continue this process, fill all of them to infinity, and you've drawn some very complicated network, which a priori sounds like it would be a completely horrible thing.
Not that I don't understand. If you look at this from the perspective of the IK foliation, what sort of point is that?
It's just a totally generic point of the IK foliation.
Then it can go the other direction.
In principle, I could have drawn it to go the other direction.
Yes.
But I have a definite rule here. So these things are oriented.
Orientation.
This is my rule. Yeah. So.
But it actually starts from somewhere else.
You could, if you like, extend this thing infinitely in the other direction. But you don't do that. That line is not part of the network. So this is the definition of what the network actually is. But that's right. It's important that it involves just sort of generic points of the surface. So what happens to this thing? Well, if the surface has no punctures on it at all, if these differentials had no singularities, then this network will be very complicated. The trajectories are running around forever and bumping into each other, and you get an extremely crazy sort of dense picture. Now, in practice, what we'll usually do is, as you know from the physics, you usually consider theories where there are some punctures. We'll put some singularities, and those singularities, the blue dots here, these kind of singularities have the effect of sort of attracting the trajectories so that they don't run around forever. Eventually, they fall into these singularities. And so the pictures, as I'll show you, won't be that bad.
Tell us a bit about the physics.
Yeah, okay, so why am I drawing this picture? So yeah, very good. Why would you be led to consider this network? Okay, I'll do that first and then show you the pictures. So the reason is, it's the answer to a pretty natural question, actually.
Just before we go in there, I don't understand. So where does it start? Why don't you consider the previous part of the IK trajectory? How can you?
I could, but I've made a definite definition, right?
What was the definition?
The definition is
you studied that IJ.
I start with the branch points, and I. The only networks that I begin with, they're born from the branch points. I draw only those trajectories, only those. And then when those trajectories hit each other, they can produce some children, and then those children can interbreed with the...
But it might have come from another branch point, then.
Right, it might have, and generally it does. So, right, so it might have come from another branch point, so it'll lead to a complicated structure.
An IK thing might have come from another branch point.
I could have also had an IK thing that came from another branch point.
But generically, you won't have a triple intersection point of your... You start drawing your trajectory, and generically, you won't have a triple...
Right, this one is just born here.
Okay.
And it evolves. In a second, I'll show you pictures of it. But first, let me answer this question. So why? So why? What's the physics of this? So the physics is the following thing. So as I said, we have this theory. You have this four-dimensional quantum field theory that comes from the 2-0 theory reduced on the curve. Now. So there's a natural kind of supersymmetric surface defect in that theory, corresponding to points z of the curve. So let's call the surface defect Sz, corresponding to a point z. Now suppose I consider the following thing. In fact, it's even better to think about not a single surface defect, but a pair of surface defects. So let's have two surface defects, Sz and Sz prime. And now, so think of what those things look like in space. So I've got a four-dimensional field theory. A surface defect, factor out the time, it looks like a line, right? A line in space. So let's set up a situation where I have a surface defect Sz, the surface defect Sz prime, connected by a supersymmetric interface. What's a supersymmetric interface? Well, as it turns out, those also exist in this world, and they correspond to paths from z to z prime. So there's a supersymmetric interface. So interfaces between Sz and Sz prime correspond to paths p from z to z prime. Okay. So let me draw the picture on the curve. So here's a little region of C. I've got my two points, Z and Z prime, and I've got some path between them. Now, in this situation, you can study the BPS states in this Hilbert space. So there's not a lot of supersymmetry left because I put in these surface operators, and I put in this supersymmetric interface, which breaks even half of the supersymmetry preserved by the surface operators. But still, you can ask for states of the theory that preserve all that supersymmetry. That's what we call the frame 2D 4D BPS states. Now you ask the following question. The spectrum of frame 2D 4D BPS states, a priori, can depend on all parameters of the theory. Depends on the Coulomb branch modulus, which I've been holding fixed, but also can depend on the positions of these surface operators. Now you ask yourself, where are the walls of marginal stability for those frame 2D 4D BPS states? And the answer is that the walls of marginal stability are exactly this network. So this network is the answer to a physical question, but it just takes a little while to explain what the question is. The question is, what is the pattern of walls of marginal stability for the frame 2D 4D BPS states? Okay, so that should at least convince you that it's some physically natural object. I have not explained the relation. Oh, do I want to explain the relation to wall crossing here? It's a little tricky, right? This is the wall crossing for the unframed BPSD. I'd rather not. This picture has something to do with the wall crossing formula for the pure 2D BPS states, not the framed ones. But let me not try to tell that story. Okay, so far I've defined this spectral network, but you may not have a feel for what it is. So let me try to show some pictures of what they look like. I'm hopeful that this will work. It worked this morning. Yeah, very good. Okay, so. So as we said, the spectral network depends on a bunch of data. It depends on a curve and some differentials and a choice of k. So let me draw first the very simplest possible spectral network. So the simplest possible spectral network, this is in the theory with k equals 2, so it's just the old A1 story. So here I've drawn a situation where the covering just has a single branch point, which is here. And so my rules say, OK, from that point, I should draw three trajectories emerging and let them evolve. In this case, they just go to a singularity, which is at infinity. Now, the whole thing also depended on a choice of a phase. How does that phase enter the story? Well, the role of that phase is it just kind of rotates this picture. OK, so that's a very trivial kind of S-wall network, but that's the first one that you encounter. OK. Now, what's something more interesting that can happen? Here's the next simplest situation. Now I have two branch points. This is still the A1 theory. I have two branch points instead of one. And now I'm getting this slightly more complicated pattern on the curve C. So this is the pattern of walls of marginal stability for the 2D 4D frame BPS states. Now, if I study how this one varies with theta, there's something interesting that happens. So you see there's a sort of critical phenomenon here where two of the walls are almost hitting each other. Right? Now, generically, that doesn't happen. But if you look at a family, right, we're varying this phase parameter. This is a sort of codimension one thing. And so it'll happen in that family some finite number of times. So here it happens once. There's a sort of there's a discontinuous jump in what the S1 network looks like before and after this this critical phase. So this, as I may or may not get time to say, these discontinuous jumps are what we'll eventually associate with the BPS states of the 4D theory. So if you like, the integers that we're going to attach to a point of the Hitchin system have to do with counting how many times such a jump occurs.
All BPS states?
Of the four-dimensional theory.
All of them.
All of them, that's right. So this theory just has one. This theory just has one BPS state because as I sweep through this all possible phases, this discontinuous jump occurs exactly once. Okay, so let's see. There's fancier examples. I'll show you very quickly. So here's a theory with three BPS states. This is still A1. You know, 1, 2, 3. So you can have a lot of fun doing these kind of things. Just so you don't get the idea that the number is always finite. Here's a situation where you have infinitely many. So every time these two lines hit each other, that's a BPS state. So this is infinitely many BPS states. And this is the tower of dions in the Seiberg-Witten theory, in the pure n equals 2 Seiberg-Witten theory. Oops. Right. So that's some complicated story. But now I want to come to the.
There was a pole there, or what was the special?
What happened right at the critical phase? Okay.
The point was a pole of the metamorphic.
Oh, this point in the middle. Yes, that's right. This point in the middle is a singularity. So in the previous pictures, I had the singularities only at infinity. But now, to get the more interesting structure, I have to have more than one singularity. So here I have one both at infinity and at zero, exactly. And I've got two branch points of the covering here and here.
What is the physical implication for phase?
The phase corresponds to the phase of the central charge of the BPS states. So you know, in the n equals 2 supersymmetry algebra, but central charges are complex. So there's that phase always in this thing.
These are the framed BPS states.
These are the unframed BPS states.
No, the phase is still.
Okay, if you ask me what does the network correspond to, you're right, that corresponds to framed BPS states with a specific phase.
2D 4D system, not of the 4D system.
The 2D 4D system, yeah. In that case, the way the phase gets in is, in fact, the supersymmetric interface preserves only some subset of the supercharges. The interface itself actually depends on a phase.
And the
phase of the 40 BPS state?
The phase of the 40 BPS state.
That's the angle, or what?
That's the angle at which it appears in this picture.
Which it appears.
Exactly.
Are you going to explain what this means in terms of Lagrangians also?
In terms of Lagrangians, very briefly, I mean, this picture, so.
Oh, no, I mean, I understand that there is some vibration of the test, and this is some other projection to the curve of the.
That's right, I'm not going to say more than that.
Special Lagrangian, but in terms of the Foucault category that you mentioned. Right? But these 42D states are, and why the 42D states?
No, that's a very interesting question. What's the categorical?
They give you the actual count of special Lagrangians. And
So first of all, the special Lagrangians correspond to just the pure 4D states, the ones that are represented by these jumps of the.
These are the actual Lagrangians.
Right? Those are the actual Lagrangians. Right. The 2D, 4D states and other stuff, we don't know, though we made some conjectures, but we don't know how to fit those into the categorical framework. I think that's a very interesting question. What do those have to do, you know, how would a guy who thinks about Foucault categories understand those invariants? But that no one is.
But that's why it might be interesting to understand the categorical structure on this level of the curve before talking about Foucault categories, so that you learn something about Foucault categories.
You may well be right. It might be, it seems like a good idea to me, but I'm not an expert on Foucault categories, so most of that I sort of rely on what Smith and Bridgeland. So far everything I told you was part of the sort of A1 story. That was just kind of review. All the pictures I showed you, rather. But now I want to show you the first picture that's really new. So this is a picture of the of a theory that has k equals 3 now. So now this is the three-sheeted covering over this plane with three branch points. And now it has a new feature, which is the lines can cross, right? Because they're ij lines for different i and j's. So there's no obstruction to them crossing.
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, I could. That's right. So with respect to some trivialization of the covering, I could even say exactly what they are. I could say this one is, so to speak, a 1, 2 branch point, and the bottom two are 2, 3 branch points. In the mathematical picture, I don't choose any cuts, so I can't put global labelings on the thing. But that's the structure. So here, we see these lines intersecting, but nobody is being born. And that's because these intersections are of the type. Yeah, I guess I hadn't drawn that. So if it's jk and ij, someone's born. And if it's ij and jk, someone's born. But if it's, for example, ij and kj, then nobody is born. And that's what's happening here. So now, let me do the same thing I did before. Let me watch how this thing evolves through 2 pi. I should do it slower. So the first thing that happens is that these things start to overlap in a different way, and you see some new lines being born, but just shooting off sort of harmlessly to infinity. Then, as we evolve the thing a little bit more, something interesting is happening in the middle. And there's going to be a critical moment now where there'll be a discontinuous jump. So if you look at the picture right here, we've got the lines that came out of here, and then we've got some secondary lines that were born at these intersections that are also going off to infinity. And now, at this critical moment, something special happens. And on the other side, I've now got a different pattern from what I had before. These lines are shooting out in different directions. So just to show again the discontinuous jump, it jumps like that. And that jump is again associated with a BPS state of the 4D theory, but it's a BPS state of a new kind that we didn't have in the A1 case.
Can you tell mathematically what a BPS state is in this Donaldson Thomas language?
For the moment, the best I could do is to define for you, I hope I'll have time, is to define for you the integer invariants, which are to be identified with Donaldson Thomas invariants. Roughly speaking, the invariant will just be counting the number of pictures of some specific type. So for example, here, so let me classify the kinds of special phenomena that we've seen so far. So one thing that we saw was two trajectories meeting back to back, one that comes out of one branch point, another coming out of the other branch point and hitting each other. That was what happened in the A1 examples. There was also a phenomenon where a trajectory that was like this, that was also in the A1 examples. And now there's something new, what we're seeing right here, what we're seeing right here is three trajectories meeting like this. So where this is 1, 2, this is 1, 3, sorry, in some labeling, 1, 2, 2, 3, and 3, 1. So this kind of situation, as it turns out, is also associated with the jump of this S-wall network. And so this is another thing that we're going to count as a BPS state.
Are these different from the physics language in these terms of this interface?
No, fundamentally, they're still the same kind of thing. I mean, these are, the fastest way I can say the meaning of this thing is that it's a string network. So, you know, in the 2, 0 theory, you have strings, and these are literally the profiles of some strings. So you can have, so here, you know, this is the situation where we just have a finite string beginning and ending on these branch points. And here is the situation where we have a kind of string network.
So one is a hypermultiplet, the other one is a vector multiplet.
Right. Oh. Right. So this one has no moduli, so it's again a hypermultiplet, actually. So this one just contributes omega equals to 1. Yeah, I should say. Sorry, of course, that's right. So in the case of, as far as I know, in the case of AK, these things haven't been studied before. In the case of A1, we studied their wall crossing, but before that, they had been studied. This picture of the BPS state had been described by Lersch, Meyer, Waffa, and Warner. Wait, someone else? Clem, Lersch, Meyer, Waffa, and Warner. Right. So for A1, this picture, this is a sort of familiar picture. But the higher ones, I think, are new. So these S-wall networks. So this is to give you first some idea of what the S-wall networks look like, and second of all, to say that their jumps are what we're going to attach Donaldson and Thomas invariants to. Let me just show you a slightly more intricate thing that can happen. So here's a situation with 6 branch points. And again, we're just, this is in the K=4 theory, that's right. This is in the picture in the K=4 theory with 6 branch points. And you can get actually quite a lot of stuff happening. Yeah, so this is the most interesting picture. Right, so this is the sort of higher rank analog of that thing that I had in K=1. So in K=1, I had something where the trajectories were winding around and around and around. Here, it's funny, there's no singularity, there's no topology, but yet they managed to do something very similar. Right? So there's sort of, you know, there's some rich structure in these networks. So. But nevertheless, I mean, the thing is kind of controlled. It's not like a dense picture. It's a well-controlled object. Okay. So I think that's all I wanted to show for pictures of these things. So now let me define. So I've been saying sort of vaguely something about Donaldson and Thomas invariants. So let me try to make a sharp statement about it. So BPS degeneracies. Or Donaldson and Thomas invariants. So as we just said, as we just saw in pictures, at some special values of theta, the spectral network jumps discontinuously. And the sort of hallmark of those values of theta at these theta there exists what I'll call a collision. In other words, the network has a subnetwork where trajectories are meeting head on. So the pictures were like this. We could have these two things hitting each other. We could have, in this case, if you draw the whole network, you'll see that it actually has, again, things going in both directions along this whole subnetwork. There can even be, as I'm sure you can imagine, more elaborate things. You can have a network like this. The subnetwork can look like this. It can be a sort of arbitrarily complicated thing with trivalent vertices, where an ij, a jk, and a ki are colliding. And then you can also have things like this. So I want to explain how to sort of count these objects. So whenever we have such a subnetwork, so it'll be a BPS state, but a BPS state of what charge? So the idea is that the subnetwork can be canonically lifted to a class gamma in the homology of the Cyber-Gwynn curve, the homology of the spectral curve. And this is exactly the charge lattice of charges in the theory. So this is going to be the charge of the BPS state, this class. So how do you get it? Well, it's okay, this contains the infrared charge lattice. Everything I'll say will be fine even with that line. So how do you do the lift? Well, the idea is that just when you have a trajectory, an ij trajectory lifts to a trajectory on sheet I and a trajectory on sheet j. So I just take this trajectory, I lift it up to sheet I with the same orientation, and I lift it to sheet j, but I take the opposite orientation. OK, that gives me, in general, some open thing. But if I take those lifts for all of the strands of this network, then the endpoints close up in such a way that I get a closed cycle upstairs. So the simplest thing to picture is this one. So this is just a trajectory on sheet I, a trajectory on sheet j. But their endpoints close up because the endpoints are exactly the branch points where sheet I hits sheet j. And there's a more complicated version of that that works here, here, and here, and so on. So that'll be. So that's the charge of the corresponding BPS state. It's just given by that sort of topology.
It's always a loop, right? It's always, even if there is like an extra trivalent.
Not quite always. So for example, in this case, the thing lifts to two loops that are disconnected. So it's closed, but it might not be connected. But whatever it is, I just take.
How there they get separated? It's a little bit. And then you have an extra trivalent vertex.
Which one?
Groove out, right?
This one?
Special one. Yeah, there.
So this one is still, this one closes to a single loop still.
But so somehow you have several branches there.
Yeah. I mean, this one is on branch, this one is ij, yeah. This one is jk, and this one, well, I can orient it either way. If I orient it this way, it's ki. So there's sort of, this one has 2 points in the boundary, this one has 2 points, and this one has 2 points, but those three group up into, yeah, so it all works.
But the threefold in the Lagrangian, this is connected. I mean, this is connected.
It's connected, that's right, and it's connected even in this case, it's connected, just its topology is different. So these ones will have topology S3, these ones will have topology S2 times S1. And related to that, they have moduli. This one also has moduli, because I could draw a closed curve in here. But so So that's the charge of my BPS state. And now, so now I can define these numbers. So I think I have enough time to do it. I'll do it over here. So for any gamma, I'll define omega of gamma to be the number of such collisions with gamma. So the number of such collisions that appear as I vary my parameter theta continuously through all values of 2 pi. And counted with a sign minus one to the number of loops. The experts will ask, how is this going to give -2 for this one? Because this one is supposed to be the BPS vector multiplet. So the way that you get -2 is that this one always comes with a partner. So whenever there's one of them, there's actually always 2 of them. And each of those is giving me -1, so I get -2.
But there could be 2 different things which lead to the same problem.
In principle, you know, we haven't quite ruled that out, although in the A1 theories, it never happens. In the A1 theories, you can see it never happens. It never happens except for this sort of situation where you have a loop. So in general, when you have loops, you expect that kind of thing. If you don't have loops, I think we don't expect it, although it's not a theorem. If there's more, I count all of them. So now here's the conjectures. So number one, the sort of most physical statement is that omega of gamma are the BPS degeneracies in this 4D theory. That comes from the physical picture of string networks.
But also, is that obvious that it only depends on the homology class of the loop?
Is it obvious that what only depends? I defined it in such a way that it depends only on the homology class. I just defined it to be the set of all guys whose lift is in that class.
So, but then it's not necessarily finite, or?
Ah, okay. So, yeah, part of the conjecture is that it's finite. It's impossible. Yes. Part of the statement or the conjecture is that it's finite. So, number two is that So these are some integers which I defined, but they depended on all of my structure. They depended on the theory, the choice of the curve C, together with the point of the Hitchin base, in other words, the point of the Coulomb branch. Now, they can depend. They depend on the point of the Coulomb branch. And so the second prediction is that they depend on phi 2 up to phi k. In a precise way that's governed by the so-called wall-crossing formula of Consavius-Soybeldt. This one makes no sense for mathematicians, but this statement makes sense for mathematicians, which is why I listed it separately. And number three, so this is sort of prerequisite for them being Donaldson-Thomas invariants, because Donaldson-Thomas invariants are always supposed to obey this formula. And so the third conjecture would be that they actually are Donaldson-Thomas invariants. That's the thing that I stated at the beginning. So the generalized Donaldson-Thomas invariants attached to the Fukaya category of a local Calabi-Yau, the same Calabi-Yau that I mentioned before in A, the one that was studied by Dioscanescu, Danagi, and Pentev, and Bridgeland and Smith for A1. Okay.
Well, it's the mirror of the one that Donaghi and Al study. No, they do the B model one, right?
But that's the one I want. Fukaya category.
Right.
I think I have it right.
You don't want the toric one.
No, I don't think so.
So it's not toric?
It's, as far as I know, not toric. So it's the one studied by... Okay.
Well, the variable toric.
So, I'm almost sure it's the one of Diaconescu, Dinaghi, and Pantev, but to be safe, I'll formulate the conjecture exactly like this. Some local Calabia.
So it's different from the Calabiau resolution of the Calabiau cone of the YPQ space subtension?
Okay, the question is about the YPQ spaces. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert on the YPQ spaces, so I can't answer that question.
Does the number of loop correspond to the spin of the biggest multiplex? So if you keep track of this number of loop, you can refine the counting here?
It's possible. Okay, the question is whether you can get the refined invariance just by keeping track of these numbers of loops. That would have worked.
Because, two loops, vector out to one loop, have a multiple.
It seems natural, right? It would have worked in the A1 theory.
Number of loop correspond to the spin, so.
I think that's the natural guess, but I don't want to make any claim about that.
Conjecture 2 for SU2 is a theorem, actually.
Yeah, so sorry. As I said at the beginning, a lot of this stuff is not conjecture in the case of A1. And in particular, that's right. These two statements and this statement is being done now by Bridgeland and Smith, I understand. But the first two are certainly theorems in this case. I mean, number one is the theorem of Clem, Lersch, Meyer, Boff, and Warner, and this one is obvious.
Is there any sort of physic way to actually check those conjectures for the other number with hypotheses, a k greater than one?
Well, you might think that it's already a theorem. I mean, the picture of these, the physics picture of these things is just that there's some appropriate string networks in the 2,0 theory. The only thing you might wonder about is whether we're counting them, we're dealing correctly with their moduli, right? So there's some question of quantization of moduli spaces. So here I gave a definite rule for what the answer should be. That rule I would say is the most provisional part of the story. It's conceivable that it'll change by the time the paper is published. But could it be checked? I mean, the way to get it from physics would be to just directly, actually perform correctly the quantization of those moduli spaces of BPS string networks. I don't know how to do that myself. Okay, yeah.
Consistency of the fringe BPS wall crossing implies the 2D 4D wall crossing formula, which, as a subcase, implies conjecture 2.
Okay, that's of course true. So there's indeed a second way of trying to get it. Which is in fact closer to what we're actually doing. So there's another way of getting these numbers, which is from the consistency of the whole elaborate structure of wall crossing, of 2D, 4D wall crossing. Yeah. That sort of pushes it down to a more primitive question about the 2D BPS states, which you might find to be easier.
For a given theory, do you have a generating function of the omegas?
You know, we've never written down any sort of useful generating function of these BPS numbers. It's sometimes useful to write down generating functions for the frame BPS numbers. In fact, those are what gives you the vevs of line operators. But as far as I know, we haven't found any use for a generating function that organizes these numbers.
For the KS product itself.
Well, the KS product, okay, if you call that a generating function.
It's a Abelian generating function.
But you can't.
Well, it's not Abelian, so it's not easy.
That's true. Okay, that's true. There is a gadget that you can make out of these BPS numbers, which sort of tells you, it essentially tells you the effect of these BPS states on the frame BPS states. You can make a sort of,
How would you know which gammas are actually occupied or which ones?
How would you know?
Which elements of the charge lattice actually correspond to BPS states that are stable?
So your question is how to compute these numbers in practice.
Yeah.
So I gave you in principle a rule, you just look at all these networks and you count them. Now, maybe you want a rule that doesn't involve staring at a computer screen for,
Yes, for SU2 size of working with you.
Yeah, that's right. So there is another way. So at least for the A1 theories, we gave an actual recipe for doing it, which remarkably involves just looking at one of these S1 networks. You just look at one S1 network, you do a computation, and you find the whole spectrum. That we haven't generalized to higher rank, although in principle there's no obstruction.
So what are the walls in the space of...
The walls along which these things jump? Yeah, the walls, it's easy enough to say where the walls are. So, in order to define the walls, I have to introduce one more little notation. Let me define z gamma. So gamma was, again, the class in H1 of sigma z. Let me define z gamma to be the period of the canonical tautological one-form on the spectral curve, right? So along the cycle gamma. So then the walls are where two of those numbers, so generically those are two random complex numbers, right? They're functions on the Hitchin base, but they're complex valued. If it should happen that two of them actually become aligned, so the locus where two of them become aligned and where both of these things are non-zero, these are where the walls are. So there's some, you know, there's some real codimension one loci inside the Hitchin base, and those are the loci where these numbers can jump.
They're reasonable, so.
They're sort of reasonable. I mean, what can I say? They're defined by this equation. If you ask me what they are, it's actually not so easy to figure out where they are in practice. I mean, for example, even in the very simplest example, these periods, say for the pure SU2 theory, one of the examples that I showed on my list, sort of typical example. These periods, you know, are some integrals over some elliptic curve. So you get some hypergeometric functions, and the question is, when is the ratio of those two hypergeometric functions a real number? So it's some nice locus, but it's not like algebraic. I mean, I could draw it on a computer, but I can't express it more directly. I'm done, certainly. I'm done.
Further question.
One question. Essentially, these are, you know, triple string junctions. F theory, you know, you have this Bronze, Bronze or PQ, but it's also there are also five brain PQ networks and this kind of thing. Is there a relationship?
Is it somehow dual to this? There probably is. I think those networks. So it. In the F-theory engineering things that I know about,
paper by Bergman and Dugin studied for SU2, they did an edge there or something very close to them.
I think that it actually has a slightly different nature from the ones that I'm drawing here. So those networks, unless I'm mistaken, and I can be mistaken, but I think that those networks are networks which are, rather than being on this auxiliary curve C, are essentially on the Coulomb branch. Now, the networks I drew here were not on the Coulomb branch, but they fit into the same kind of structure. So these walls were associated with wall crossing of 2D, 4D frame BPS states. There's also walls directly on the Coulomb branch, which have to do with the wall crossing of just frame 4D BPS states. And there's a similar story where you can construct the 4D BPS states by looking at that network. I think that network is the one that's appearing in this F theory stuff. So it's not.
Well, maybe a related question is how this 2D, 4D story fits in the F theory description. This may be another way of asking this question.
Yeah, how does the 2D, 4D relate to F theory? That I have to plead ignorance on. I don't know. Maybe I should have said, there's one other thing that I should have said, which is that. In the case of the A1 theories, these spectral networks turn out to be pretty simple things. They look like, a typical picture looks like this. So they're sort of, they correspond to triangulations, certain triangulations of the surface C. That's how it gets connected to the shear coordinates of Fock and Gonchharov. So what we're having here is some generalization. If you calculate the VEVs of line operators in these theories, you're supposed to get a generalization of the shear coordinates for higher rank.
So I'm sure why you need these networks instead of just looking at the critical network.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe a different question is in which other context you can describe these networks, for example, in terms of the quiver. Can you describe these spectral networks in terms of the quiver when these BPS states are the stable representations of the quiver or something like this?
Right. So let me take the second part. So in the A1 case, of course, there seems to be a picture like that where the edges of this triangulation correspond to nodes of some quiver, and you build up the BPS spectrum. I described it one way, but an equivalent way of describing it is in terms of the representations of that quiver. Now, you can ask, what's the extension of that to higher rank?
Where are the spectral networks in this?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So I drew this.
There I can see the actual BPS states are the stable representations of the quiver.
Right. So, I drew this picture, I think, slightly too fast. So in the A1 case, let me draw a picture of what a spectral network typically looks like. So in the A1 case, with punctures that have, just for simplicity, that have second-order poles, let's say. Second-order poles of the quadratic differential. Then a typical picture of what this spectral network would look like is something like this. You have three prongs coming out of each turning point, each branch point, and each prong goes down to some singularity. So here's an example of a spectral network. Now, given such a spectral network, I can make a triangulation of the surface. The idea is that each of these cells, so I've sort of divided the surface up into cells, and each cell contains one edge of my triangulation. Namely, the cell has two singularities on it, the blue dots, and I just draw the edges running from one to the next. So here's a triangulation where each face of the triangulation sort of contains one of these branch points. Now, so this is actually the object we used in the A1 case before we realized that the spectral network is better. In this case, they're just equivalent. So now, from the triangulation, you can make a quiver. Namely, the edges of the triangle, the edges of the triangulation correspond to nodes of this quiver, and there's a superpotential term for each face, and the edges correspond to the incidence relations among the The arrows of the quiver correspond to incidence relations among these edges. Now, it's believed, in fact, I think Bridgeland and Smith are proving this, that the BPS state counting in this theory is the same as doing the Donaldson-Thomas invariance attached to that quiver. So I thought that was the context of your question. You were asking whether that could be extended to higher rank. Was that not the context?
I wasn't really aware of this part.
Oh, what were you saying about quivers? Anyway, just to finish that story, so it should be possible to extend it to higher rank. So we take the spectral network and draw a quiver out of it, and the BPS states correspond to that quiver. But I wouldn't put it at the level of the conjectures we had here. But that's one place where the spectral network directly enters.
But the representation of this quiver, the 2D 4D states or the
4D? No, pure 4D states. Pure 4D states. But there's a baby example of that in Seiberg-Witten theory, right? The BPS states in Seiberg-Witten correspond to the representations of this quiver with two nodes and two arrows. So that's an example of this phenomenon.
That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. So in that case, if you draw the spectral network, it gives you exactly that quiver.
But spectral network, there are other spectral networks. Rotate.
They're related by mutation to this one.
If you rotate the theta, it's going to be different.
Yeah, those are mutations. That's a beautiful thing. So if you rotate this theta, then the cluster coordinates are also associated. Cluster coordinates on Hitchin moduli space are associated to these. And so as you rotate theta and you make one of these discontinuous jumps that Andy's talking about, then you induce cluster transformations on those coordinates.
Right, that's the part I unfortunately didn't have time. Yeah.
Another question. You listed a number of ingredients which go into this construction. On the other hand, of course, there is also some ingredient which sort of determines the shapes of these lines. Essentially, they should be geodesic. I didn't hear this word, and certainly this is related to BPS property, and certainly hidden is a differential equation which determines the shape of these things.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I wrote that equation at the beginning. Yeah, let me rewrite that equation. So the equation was that that this particular one form should be real.
All right. Okay.
Positive.
Yeah. That's a crucial ingredient in this thing. And it is like being a geodesic in some flat metric.
Yeah.
But unlike in the A1 case, it's not a global flat metric. It depends on this sheet.
But this geodesic, this sounds a bit sort of geometric and sounds like a differential equation. On the other hand, the arguments you present are more topological.
Well, that's part of what's really interesting about this thing is that, I mean, so yeah, studying these particular trajectories gives you one very specific network which is absolutely rigid. You know, these lines are determined by some differential equation, but nevertheless, it's really the topology of the thing that somehow plays the key role.
So what about the edges of those regions in the space of stability condition? You said there were higher hypersurface walls, but
right.
Then when you close them down, I'm sure you will get some edges and corners and
some kind of facets. Yeah.
Lower dimensional stuff.
Yeah, but what happens there is, at least as far as the invariants go, what happens at those sort of tougher strata is determined by what happens in the.
Of course, but you might be able to study what happens directly when you cross the lower dimensional wall.
When you go into some locus where a lot of these Z's are lining up at the same time.
I am asking this because I expect that at those smaller dimensional walls you will see the singular fibers.
Right. When some of the Z's go to zero. Yeah, the singular fibers in this business are the places where some of the Z's go to zero. And yeah, those of course are quite important, and they are loci where some walls are colliding. I agree. Yes.
Yeah, I'd like to just make one more comment about this equation you just wrote, which is that these lines are related to WKB analysis for higher rank ordinary differential equations on the curve C, the ultraviolet curve C. And I mention that because I don't know how much the mathematicians really know about how to do these. I mean, for the A1 case, for SU2, it's like a Schrodinger equation. People know how to handle WKB. But for higher rank, WKB is a much, much more subtle thing. And what we think is that the spectral network is the right way to encode WKB asymptotics for higher rank differential equations. And these become Stokes walls.
Yes, agreed.
You mentioned that it might be possible to be done the refined version because the quivers set up now as a refined version mathematically. You have a quiver with a potential. I think you can define the refined Donald's of Donald's invariant. So what would you count then? I mean, you would have to refine your count of.
Right. So yeah, there's a natural way of trying to enrich this story. Unfortunately, I told you the statements, but I didn't really tell you how we try to prove them. So the way we try to prove them, in fact, begins from this 2D, 4D story that I mentioned in answer to Bogdan's question. That story, we haven't completely worked out the refined version of. It ought to be possible, we just haven't done it. Once you do that, it'll lead to the refined version of discounting.
No, what you do with these, they will come in moduli, and then there'll be spins, and then we'll have
this. That's a natural guess. Okay, so a natural guess is the guess that we mentioned before, that the spin, the sort of higher, the power of Q, is just related to the number of loops on the corresponding object. That's a natural guess, but if we want to prove it, we can either do it by the physics of this quantization, or we can do it by this 2D, 4D thing. Neither one of those has yet been there. But yeah, there is a guess.